What I'm going to talk about today, I hope I don't offend anybody. So let me declare that all the opinions are from myself. I don't really represent any institution's opinion. Let me start. So I think I will talk about four things maybe people may have interest to hear. One is how do I view about disruptive innovation? And then tell the digital domain story how we, the early days, how do we create the company, and what I think are the key factors that leading digital domain to be successful. And finally, I want to talk about what I see, why innovations in large company are difficult, and also what's the relationship of research and innovation in university environments, since many participants in this conference are from universities. So let me go to the first issue. What is a disruptive technology? I think Clayton Christensen probably coined the terminology first back in 97 when he wrote a book on Innovator's Dilemma. So here's what he says, right? The first, he said, disruptive technologies emerge, the innovation that result in worse product performance usually, and at least in the near term. But disruptive technology bring to a market a very different value proposition than had been available previously. And they have other features that a few fringe customers value. So that's one way to look at this, right? You can also think disruptive technology enable us to build products that can disrupt a particular market. But I think Christensen's definition still makes sense to me, and also he used this figure to characterize the disruptive technology. You start at the low performance use case. You know, that's the curve at the very bottom, then across many use cases. The other curves are sort of sustained improvements. So most of the large companies or mature products are on this performance curve that gradually improving. But disruptive technology was able to cross those use cases and quickly cross over all the way to the high performance use cases. So that's his definition. So let's look at what the data domain, whether the technology we created match his model. So let me start talking about what is the data domain that was from 2001 to 2009. So this is had a snapshot from our business plan. So we said data domain mission was to become the premier supplier of online restore repository system and software for medium and large enterprises. So that was the mission. And what we're talking about in the business plan was the vision to replace tape library in the data centers. So for those of you who remember the traditional data center, typically you have this ecosystem where clients are connecting to server, then you connect to storage, then for certain use cases you may have dedicated network connecting to mirror to do active failover. And then you need to protect data, especially version data, and put it on a tape library and ship to remote locations. And if you're trying to change that ecosystem using traditional disk storage, you would end up having to pay a lot of money, not only by the purchase price, because you have to retain a lot of data. Even if you return data for 3 months, you would need to keep probably about 20 times of the primary storage data. And this, by the way, this is the figure we used in the early days. I just copied from the old presentation. Then also, if you move data over the network for disaster recovery, network cost is very high. In fact, they don't improve very much, probably improved by about factor 2 during the last decade, when data improved probably by a factor of 100. And also, you consume a lot of power. Our vision was to build a deduplication storage ecosystem that you have a small local storage box storing your backup data and use the traditional wider network to move data to the remote site for disaster recovery. And the value propositions were, one is we want to sell the products at a similar price as tape library solution. And we want to reduce the data footprint by order magnitude. And we want to reduce the network bandwidth also by order magnitude. And when you can do all those things, you can also perhaps reduce the power consumption by order magnitude. So if you're introducing a product that's similar in price to the existing solution, and you have several value propositions that bring value, have an order magnitude effect, and then it's appealing to some of the customers early days, just like Christensen mentioned. So here are the two photos I liked, which we see from the sales guys at some point. I think this may be 2007 or 2008. Some of the data domain guys may remember. So this was in one data center that has 17 IBM tape libraries. And then when they replaced with the data domain boxes, there are three of them, 3U in one rack. So I think this is why sometimes a picture is worth 1,000 words. So if we look at the what Christian defined about the property of disruptive technology, and we look at what the data domain was doing, and you can sort of see this figure in terms of deduplication throughput improvement that quickly crossed with the tape sustained improvement in performance, you know, in addition to interesting technologies, right? So that this is just give a quick overview of what's happened in the room. In terms of product revenue, the numbers I was able to keep track was obviously at the beginning there was no revenue, and so that axis dimensions were the time and also the fundraising events, including the acquisition back in middle of 2009. So you can see the revenue has been ramping up fairly quickly, although I don't really have last year number. But 2011 was over $1.5 billion. So I think also for roughly from 2006, when the market started established, I think data domain was able to maintain the market percentage probably over 60%, and I believe over the last several years, the gross margin is greater than 73. At the time of IPO, we spent about $27 million of funding. So let me give you some piece of information about how data domain was created. Obviously, we have to talk about the co-founders, and we have other great people right after. So here are the three happy people. look much younger, and created 1 month after September 11th, 2001. And so let me just talk about our approach we have to the creation of the company. First, I think we were established concept that whatever we want to build, we should build something that's considered must-have. What is must-have? I think the metaphor we're using, or analogy we're trying to, we've been talking about at the time was nice to have is, you know, vitamins is like nice to have. So if you don't have money, you would not buy. But must-have are things like antibiotics or perhaps painkillers. So if you don't have them, you will die or you will suffer in a major way. So we're thinking at the time, we didn't really know what we really want to build at the time, but we're thinking that whatever we want to do has to have that property. I think the other interesting approach, perhaps many people didn't know, who are not in data domain didn't know, is the our technology development has always been sort of product-driven or customer-driven. So it's not a technology I or some other people developed in the university environment, then try to go to market, try to build a product out of it. Instead, we try to understand what customer market opportunity and understand what kind of product customer are willing to buy and what value, what experience we can give to customers, then work back to the technology and then figure out what we have to invent in order to do it. And I think a third approach we had was we would only talk to a few selected venture capital firms. And at the time, I think we agreed that we would, if they didn't like our idea, we would not do it. I would just go back to university and teaching and we'll part our ways. Fortunately, that didn't happen. We also have the approach that we always try to raise more money than we need. Even the, you know, for those of you who remember back in, right after September 11th, the market was essentially crashed. No one really wanted to invest, so we have to give up a lot of equity to raise a lot of money. So, but I think we kept doing that for every round of funding, trying to raise more, give up more ownership, but for the bigger, potentially bigger success, right? I think also we had this approach that we always hold very high standard for the early team to, and even we missed the hiring plan. In fact, my recollection is we always missed the hiring plan, and but we, you know, I think we missed a little bit of the engineering plan, but in general we didn't miss engineering plan for several years. I mean, probably before the acquisition, I would say. So I think basically, you're in the valley, we're in software company, a lot of people talking about, oh, we 99% of chance you're going to be delayed by big margin comparing with your development plan. But that's just not the case at the domain. So I think that has a lot to do with what kind of people we have in the team and how well they work together. I mean, I think some people are very good, even we had we parted our ways. The high standard is not just the quality of the individual, but also how well people work together. Obviously, when you have very good people, they all have strong opinions. So I think our culture has been we minimize our egos. Let's say, basically no egos and try to always take the best ideas and go with the best ideas. So that has been the approach and perhaps establish culture this way, at least early days. The timeline of the early days were the formation, as I mentioned, was October 12, 2001. And so I met the two co-founders in the summer, and we then start meeting with some of the great friends and very good people, which I wish they could be part of the founding team, like my friend Hugo Patterson, for example, who sits right there. And but he joined very early on too, so he's viewed as one of the co-founding team, I have to say. Then we started initial fundraising, which is roughly the December, in December of that year. Then that funding split into two tranches, and that was the first tranche with some deliverables. And then what we did was to go through the what we call technology and the customer validation. So we quickly built a prototype that run a production data in three data centers through in order to understand how to really design a product. Then that prototype essentially put away, then start thinking about the product requirement documents. One of my co-founders, Brian, I think is really great at working on this. And by the way, he and Hugo are now having a new outfit called Daytrim, and I'm sure they will be successful given what I know about them. I hope Hugo doesn't mind if I talk about this. And after that, I think we start doing the architecture and product design. And then we did a much bigger customer validation to see whether this kind of product, essentially iterated with the customer to see whether this kind of product they're willing to buy, or you know how excited they are. And after that, we have a business plan developed with a fairly long-term vision. And then we close the second tranche of the Series A. So just give you some feeling about what are the development early days. And this is some screenshots on the whiteboard. And those ideas eventually got published in 2008. This was developed late 2001 and 2002. And here's some screenshots of our acting CEO, Anil Bushri. We're hanging out trying to figure out the product development plan. And here's dig out from the old business plan, the companies we have done the customer validation. And so that business plan later, I think after the acquisition in 2009, some friends say, you know, we should take a look at the old business plan, what happened. So we dig out the old business plan, we look at them. I mean, essentially, during the last 7 years, we have been essentially executing that business plan. So that business plan didn't really change that much. I mean, made some adjustment, but roughly that business plan stand and pass the test of time in the history of the company. If I have to summarize these, my own way of summarizing the factors for data domain success, I would just say four things. Probably the first one, I would say the best people. We elaborate on that. Second is understanding the market. And third is to leverage the long-term technology trends. And the fourth is the new product category. So the first one, what do I mean by best people? I really meant best people in all categories. So I think in our initial team, we purposely try to recruit people with a different DNAs, if we may say that way. And also, we want to make sure people work well together. So when you try to recruit the best people, there are always some issues. I mean, for certain cases, I think you need to have, I usually serve that role, like I will try to glue people together, even I don't really, you know, I need to spend a lot of time talking to people. But you got to make sure everyone work together, making the decision that serving a single goal and working for that single goal. And we also have very good board members and advisors. I think a lot of people working in startups feel probably the VCs are evil people. There are a lot of failures. A lot of founders are complaining that VCs got them into trouble and so on and so forth. So I have a different way of thinking about this. I think if you're work with a really experienced investors, and they can help you. And in our case, I think they help us avoid making many detours. I mean, it is a very long road, 7 or 8 years. There are many decisions you have to make. I think you have people who have experience or who can draw experience from other companies who can really help help you avoid making detours. I think that's a very, I have many examples. I don't want to bore you, but I think that's what I how I feel. And also they can help with a roadmap, even design reviews and engineering design review and business plan. I think one of our board members, Forrest Bosque, spent about a year, maybe a little more than a year. We go through engineering design review once every 2 weeks. And so that's very helpful. That's we really appreciate that. I think if you, and the third one, I think, is really important to have a good management team, people work together, and that they can drive the company to the next phase. Sometimes you can view the company developing in multiple phases, driving the company to the future phases. If you have a good management team, you may not have to change them. I think that's very important. We have, in my opinion, we had a great CEO choice. After a new bursary, and we found Frank Slootman, and now he's the CEO of ServiceNow, and that company just went public last year. So here's a screenshot of some back in April 2002. So we have some the board members, advisors, and the early team. So if you look at the major management and financial events, as I mentioned, the formation of the company was 2001. I serve as the temporary CEO for 2 months. And then we raised for the first tranche Series A. Then Anil became our acting CEO. And then we raised the second tranche middle of 2002. And then Frank joined us summer 2003. Some of you may have read the little book he wrote called Tape Sucks. Well, let me put it this way. I think I agree with many things he said. There's one thing I didn't agree with him. I think probably many of the early guys didn't, which is he has one chapter that says, nobody knows. Well, when the founding team got together, I mean, including Hugo, we say, of course we knew. What do you mean by nobody knew? Otherwise, I think he's a great CEO and his book was well written. 2003, we raised the second round of funding. And what I really feel good about Frank is that he was willing to join when we about running out of first round of funding. And he didn't even, that even didn't bother him. Then we raised the third round in December of 2006. Then another round later in 2007. I think that's the third round in 2006. And that's really prepared for the IPO, but we didn't really spend much money of the third round. So then 2009, we went through the acquisition. Many people in this room knew. So why I talk about this during in this section, I called best people in all categories. I think a company development goes through multiple phases, right? If you want a company to be successful, at least based on this experience, you want to find the best people leading the company in its phase. Obviously, I feel I'm not the right person to lead the company. And I knew that from the beginning. And I could help company in other ways. And let me just validate my argument. My relationship with the revenue. So if you look like a red figure, the red curve is the amount of time I think I spend. When I spend 100% of time at Data Domain, we have zero revenue, right? The less time I spend, the more revenue it increases. So it was very clear I shouldn't be managing the company. The guys who can manage the company, here's the shot of one of the retreat we had. And this is the management team. Yes, I'm one of those guys, but those are the guys who made the especially later stage of the company successful. So the next thing I want to talk about is understanding the market, right? I think it's, our experience is that we really should have a long-term plan. In other words, have a very good roadmap or the right roadmap. So let's look back. So one of the things I did is I asked, about 2 years ago, I asked my friend Richard Johnson, who was really into keeping track of everything, to give me the dump of the number of lines of code per release since the beginning. And I put that together with the revenue curve. So as you can see that if you look at the green line, which is the number of lines of code, they're kind of interesting, right, to put them together. They go from zero. This is a release, right? Didn't go from the beginning, zero to 5 million or almost 4 million in 5 million in 2011, I think. So what is most interesting in this figure? So I have shown this to a few people, and different people have a different take on what's important. So let me try to ask you guys. Do you think the software complexity matches with revenue is most interesting? How many people feel that way? Please raise your hand. Very few. Wow. What about this? This hockey stick curve you know, somehow happened. 2007 is the time we went IPO, right? After IPO, things just going wild. How many people feel that's most interesting? I think a lot more people feel that way. Well, then obviously the question is, what do I feel is most interesting? Well, what I feel is interesting is this part. This is a before IPO. So why do I think that's interesting? Okay, let me amplify this figure a little bit. So if you look at this, you know, from end of 2001 to 2007, if you connect the dotted line, you roughly would develop 100,000 lines of code per year, independent of the size of engineering team. Now, I think that's very interesting, right? We did grow our engineering team from roughly 10 people to 2007 to over 100 people. But you still produce about 100,000 lines of code per year. So obviously, our code is very high quality, but it's still 100,000 lines of code per year. Now, naturally, the question is, which 100,000 lines of code you write in which year? I think that's very interesting, right? Because those lines of code represent some features you implement. So now, which features you want to implement year one, which one you implement year two? Well, we actually release more frequently than per year, but suppose we have one release per year, which set of features you're going to put down there, and that's your roadmap. I mean, do you want to think about a roadmap as you go, or do you think about a roadmap from the very beginning? And that, how do you figure that out? I think that's roughly how the way we feel about this is that disruptive innovation is not just a one-time event. You need to have this continuous thing going. The way I best describe would be just a loop. You iterate between technical innovation and customer validation. You know, so you got to do that for throughout the entire roadmap. You cannot stop. You just need to continue. And that's why I think this is interesting. Yes, it is true that after IPO, things going wild, and you know, I think the way I describe this is when you are a private company, when you are small, you have a vision, you have a path, you want to go from A to B. So you want to be focusing on going along this path as soon to get there from A to B as soon as possible. So you have to figure out stage that roadmap very carefully. But once you are able, you have a lot more resources, you know, you can fan out. You can afford to fan out to cover, to solve a lot of issues or barriers for customer to purchase your product. By the beginning, this phase is very important. This is why I think, looking back, I think sometimes we're consciously doing this, sometimes we're unconsciously doing this once you have developed this culture. But I think company development, and especially when we start talking about disruptive innovation, I think this approach is probably quite interesting. And the other interesting thing is I will hang out with Pat Hanrahan and Diane Green. You know, Pat was the one of the founders of Tableau, which is a very successful software company. And Diane was the former CEO of VMware, right? So we're comparing early days experience, and I think we all have this similar feeling about this, right? So this is not just data domain experience, actually. So what are the challenges, especially early days? I think I'll think about three challenges. There are a lot more, but to talk about here. One is, I think, a gross margin. I mean, every company you want to be successful, you have to reach high gross margin. In this case, we have to come up with a technology that's a way to design product that's deliver product at a similar price as the previous solution, but the company were able to reach high gross margin. In this case, deduplication or total compression where data footprint reduction has to be as high as possible. That's where the margin is coming from. But meanwhile, you have to use a minimum amount of hardware. I think that's just the concept of deduplication is not good enough. You have to have enough intellectual property or technology to make sure you use minimum amount of hardware. And that's one set of challenges. The other is the data growth rate drives the data center every day. And roughly, they're growing on the Moore's Law curve, whereas the number of hours per day is fixed. It's still 24 hours. And the amount of time you can do backup, that backup window time is fixed, 4 to 8 hours maybe. So that the throughput has to match with the data growth rate. Therefore, so that's challenging, the product design challenges. And I think the third is the deployment of products to large data centers, the challenge, because many of you probably in this room probably know that the data center customers, especially when they buy storage products, they behave very differently from buying other kind of products. So they essentially assume your products are not reliable until you prove reliable. It's like you're assuming you're guilty and you need to prove your innocence. Unlike buying other products, like buying networking products, you may assume you're innocent until you prove guilty. But here is not the case. The second observation is that the data center people move fairly slowly. Once they adopt, probably they will want to continue buying a product for a while, but it takes a long time to convince them to buy your product. It's very conservative. And maybe the third thing is that they don't really want to show up in trade shows unless you pay them to go. So essentially, if you go to storage trade shows, I think a company are telling each other what their product are building. There are very few customers showing up. So those laughing know what I'm saying is true. So you have to have enough feet on the street to knock their doors. So those are the challenges, right? So how do we solve the technical challenge? I think the way I summarize, we continuously betting on the long-term technology trends. What was the first technology trend? Well, I think I would summarize two technology trends. One is disk replace tape, right? We've seen in consumer community, disk cassette tapes were replaced by iPod, and consumer video, VCRs were replaced by DVRs or TiVo. I think so what we see is this trend that possibly happened. The tape library should be replaced by some well-designed devices, right? But you would have to have interesting technology just like audio compression, video compression to accomplish this mission. And the second is the CPU will go to multi-cores. I think back in 2001, I think we saw this type of figure in terms of the clock rate versus time, right? And we saw this past ceiling happening. And that ceiling is, told us the future of CPU is going to go to multi-cores. I think at that time, it was still quite early, but we're betting parallelism, especially using CPU parallelism to get better throughput. And the good news is that many of our guys, the core teams, have parallel computing background. And so we designed a software architecture to leverage the multiprocessing power from Intel processors. So, and in combination, we'll work on data structure algorithms intelligently. So if you look at the deduplication throughput, again, match with the revenue curve, you see we, in 6 years, we improved the throughput by a factor of 100. So the Moore's law says, you know, that would take 10 years, right? So we outrun Moore's law, not, but while we're leveraging the CPU performance improvement, but we also, meanwhile, improve the software and algorithms. And in terms of the physical storage capacity, we're improved by, my calculation shows about a factor of 300 in 6 years. And that's also due to that combination. So, well, it become much easier if you're, what you're working on somehow emerge as a new product category. So new product, new market segment or segmentation, I think is very important. It's a very big deal. Why? Because you as a small company could emerge as a leader in that segment. And then you'll be valued much higher than you're just yet another company in the segment where you have a dominator. In the storage industry, is very big, right? And there we have big dominators. It's very difficult for a smaller company to dominate them to become a leader. And when you're, so I think that's a, so the Wall Street will view you, if you emerge as a new segment, they will view you as a, they call their terminology as game changer. So how could that happen? Sometimes, you know, the market research firm can help you, and they will, they can, like a Gartner, who would produce this magic quadrant that sometimes can accelerate recognition in the marketplace as well as among your peers. There's a new market segment happening, and you know, then you'll become the leader. They put you to the right top quad, and you're at the right, as far as possible at that corner, and you'll become a leader. Well, but that did not happen with the deduplication, right? In my record, it did not happen before we went to IPO. Only after IPO, Gartner and some other well-paid research firms recognized there's a new market segment. So our luck is not in this, in the with working with the market research firm. Our luck is selling products. So that I think the customers and also the smaller research firms recognize the new market segment. And that normally did not happen, but that happened in the deduplication storage space. Let me just revisit those factors I talked about. I talked about four things, right? So I have a little time left. The best people, what I think are the key factors, understanding the market and leveraging the long-term technology trends and somehow make the new market segment emerge. So I promise that in the abstract, I will talk about innovation in large companies. I hope I don't offend anybody who are working for large companies. Well, I think probably I wouldn't offend you because you will agree with me either public or secretively, right? So let me just talk about the events happening, my version of events happening in the deduplication space. First, the large company did, even though the market research firm denied the new market segmentation, and large company did act on deduplication early. So my recollection is EMC, NetApp, and HP all had internal developments. But what happened is that soon after, they all discontinued their investigation. Maybe HP didn't, but I know EMC and NetApp did. Why? Well, I think people working in those companies could have a better explanation. I have my version of explanation, but I won't share with you since this is recorded.
Now, then what happened is the market segment emerged, right? Somehow, we're selling so much product. And then the big company jumped onto the deduplication bandwagon. How that happened? Well, Quantum bought ADIC, which bought a small deduplication software company. And EMC ended up OEM product from Quantum. Quantum product was so much later than their domain. In fact, their sales guys even use our slides when they sell. And then EMC bought a deduplication software company. And NetApp tried to implement something using on top of their existing architecture. Well, then IBM bought another deduplication storage company. Many of you know all those names of those companies. And then, but what happened is that data domain continued to take more than 60% of the market and have very high recommendation from customers. Then eventually EMC bought data domain. So that's the sequence, right? You can see that somehow in this, my version of the events, somehow large company have trouble doing this, right? They cannot do this themselves. They have to buy companies. Not just data domain, but they bought many small companies. Why is that case? Well, why is it difficult? I think here's my short list of summarization. First, I think technical people are the people who do innovations, right? I mean, you need to work with the product management people to validate the market, validate what the customer will buy, but the initial idea typically from, I would say most of the time from technical people, the product management don't innovate. I mean, they collect requirements, right? And I mean, there are some great product management guys like one of my co-founders, Brian. The reason he's great is he can really work with technical people, and together they innovate, right? So in large companies, sometimes engineers just do what a product management tell them to, and that typically ended up not innovating. And I think the key reason, number one, would be the engineers have a lack of motivations when they work in a large company. Why? They just don't seem to have the same kind of incentives as other people in the company. Like sales guys have a well-understood formula, how much product you sell, and that translates to financial incentives. Engineers don't understand that in a large company. No large company, I think, people understand that. Like, what do I have to do to have a lot of financial incentives? They don't even understand how that works. So the lack of incentives somehow translate to the feeling of no love, no love from my mothership. I think that just, some people don't really care about financial incentives, I have to say. They care about what interesting projects to work on, but somehow if you are not feeling you are valued, and you just don't have enough motivation. And in general, they just don't feel it's my company. In a small company, you feel that way, you make a decision on every day based on, is this good for the company? And when you don't really know what's good for the company, in a large company, sometimes you have management team have trouble articulate what's good for the company, then you start making decisions on, is this good for me? Is it good for my group? Is it good for my division? Sometimes the best thing for the company is the elimination of your division, right? So you would not want to go there. The second, I think, is the process for the sustained improvements stopped you from innovating. So what you do is you check with your lead customers and research firm, what feature you should deliver, how much better you need to make the product, and you, instead of innovating, customers don't innovate. They react to your innovations, right? So somehow big company have trouble doing this. And then it's very difficult to have a disruptive idea coming up that has no prior market. So the research firm and lead customers won't be able to react. And also, I think the large company have another issue, which is have many meetings and produce many PowerPoints presentations. My feeling is that Microsoft produced this product has reduced the productivity of millions. And the next thing is that even they have disruptive technology in their hand, they don't want to use it. Why? Because they may kill their own children, right? That's what the disruption is. So would a large company have this deduplication product in their hand at early days? Would they want to tell their shareholders, oh, we're developing this new product that will reduce my current product revenue by a factor of 10 because that does compression by a factor of 10. How do you feel about that? So that's the classical disruption phenomena, right? So some company just say, okay, I'm not going to take any of those kind of risk. Instead, I'll just live on acquisitions. When you are proving yourself in the marketplace, I will buy you. I have a huge successful sales team, and we'll just capitalize on that. So we know many examples. I think the last reason might be the founders have left. They're no longer where the initial founding team, where initial team have left. They are no longer in the development loop. Well, why is that important? I think there are a lot of smart people in large companies, and many of them are equally smart or perhaps smarter than the initial team guys, in my opinion. But the problem is that they don't carry the same credibility in front of the crowd. Like the initial team guys have credibility because the engineering team feel, or even the product management team feel, they're the guys who get us from zero to here. So if they say there's a, you should jump over this mountain, and a lot of people may jump because they will believe them. They wouldn't die. But other people who are equally smart but don't have enough credibility within the organization may not carry the same weight when they say something. When the engineers don't buy into your idea, even they knock your head just because you're my boss, but they would not do the work. They would just say, I have to support this, I have to do this and that. They have many reasons not to do it, right? So I think that's another reason that I found very difficult to in a large company. So I think this, I'm running out of time now, although I thought about talking about research versus innovation. But I'm going to just quickly say this. So some people are asking me, is the deduplication technology you guys were using, is that developed in university environment? I would just say no. You know, the way I look at the research versus innovation may be a little somewhat against many my colleagues in various universities, or maybe even against the idea of garments. So my feeling is that research is really not innovation. And what the definition I really like is by Gregory Nicholson. And he says that research is the transformation of money into knowledge. So you take some money and you work on things, so you create new knowledge. And innovation is transformation of knowledge into money. It's very difficult to just do one step in a university environment, transformation from money to money, right? So here's the graphically, I'll show this. So university environment, you get funding from university and government, you pump into university, you support great graduate students, they generate knowledge, put in public domain, that public domain knowledge will go back to, university or companies, and they will foster next generation of knowledge. I mean, you just keep doing this, right? Companies are different. When you do a startup, you take money. That money has different color, actually. It has chains. Then you start your company, you make product. Your product is based on market requirement. You take a tiny fraction of the knowledge. Yes, well, I have to admit that the technology we developed, at least, is based on years of research preparation. I mean, there's a lot of things we collectively we know that contribute to making the product, but it's not something we would be able to identify what we have to do in the university environment. And eventually, your product's successful, you return your investment to the investors. And if you look at the ratio, typically the VCs might, I think the top VC in the Valley funded maybe 1% of the business plan, 1% to 2% maybe. And the success rate, the known success rate of funded companies is about 10%. That's like a 0.1% of success rate. It's very, very low. When you get a research grant, that's 10% or perhaps higher. So you have like a factor of a still two order of magnitude away from what the business plan funding ratio is. So just from that angle, it's very, very different. So how do you manage relationship? I think my advice of higher relationship with university environment is you separate the two, and if you want to do a startup, you cross over. That's my experience, right? If you don't do the separation, and I think it would be, look like this cartoon, you're standing on two boats, right? So you'll be very slow. Either you're very slow, you have to go with a very slow boat, or you fall into water. Because you have potential conflicts of interest, and you're going to move very slowly. So let me just finally say that, go along this line. First, when I was working at Digital Domain, I take no pay leave from university. I work 100% of the time, even though yields no revenue. I didn't really personally work on deduplication in my research in the past. There are many successful examples from related university, and I think most of them, I would say this list, people, the founders have taken this approach, like cross, leave your research environment and put yourself 100% time into a company and try to make that happen. What are the integrated approach? Are there any examples? I think we have, U.S. government has SBIR program. You want to name very successful example, it's very hard. European Union has similar type of funding, maybe even more money. I can't even come up with one example. Well, I know something about Chinese government, and they have spent a lot of money in a similar way. I couldn't find any example either. So now I would just want to end my talk by thanking people who made the Digital Domain successful. And also I want to end it up with the quote from Steve Jobs when he gave a talk in 97. He says that you got to start with a customer experience and work to the technology. And you can't start with the technology, then try to figure out where you are going to sell it. Thank you.
Hi, Fred Douglas, EMC, and thank you for getting me my job a few years ago. But you commented at the very end that you didn't actually work on deduplication in academia before starting data domain. And the other examples that you gave there, people in academia who crossed over like that, most of these were people who were actively working on academic projects, you know, virtual machines leading into VMware and so on. So I'm curious if you can say something about how often you think it's successful to go from academia into a startup like this without having actually actively worked in that in your prior life.
Well, I would not say that your prior research has very little to do with the startup. I'm just saying when you decide to build a product, my observation, I think the point I want to make was to build a product is very important to figure out how little you have to do in order to make a product as sellable. And that skill set just not developed in university environment. The university also is not exposed to interacting with the customers directly or just understanding market directly. That part is always lacking. And to put yourself completely in the product company environment and put 100% time there to work with the people who understand market and try to make product successful, that's a bigger point I want to make. I mean, if you look at the background of myself, Ben Zhu, Hugo, we all have done a lot of parallel computing in the past. For example, I also work with a storage, but not the deduplication storage system. So many things are related, but once you understand the market requirement, it doesn't take a lot of time to figure out how to build a product right. But I think it takes which 100,000 lines we have to write, I think it's a much more important question in terms of building the product. I also feel if I don't put myself 100% time on every day in the team, people don't see me suffering, and the best people would not come. They have to see the founders suffer and work really, really hard for the company.
So I just think I would be denying my academic heritage if I didn't point out that there are other models that work. So I think Mike Stonebreaker is a different example of someone who's crossed over between research and academia, and he actually has done it regularly without leaving academia. So, you know, I don't think one's necessarily right and the other's wrong, and we should probably acknowledge that there are successful models that work.
Margo, I agree with you. I think, on the other hand, I met with Mike recently. He's changed his way of working in research now.
Oh, yeah.
His research is funded by VCs now, and his goal is to do companies.
Well, actually, that's actually a really serious conversation, that Mike's observation is that it's easier to get VC funding to build the kinds of things he wants to build than it is research funding.
Right.
And I think that's actually a really serious question for those of us in systems, which is how do we, if in fact we believe there should be systems research in the universities, how do we get a funding model that actually supports it?
I agree. Thank you.
I have a question. So from your slides, it seems there's also other small companies doing deduplication at the time your company starts. So can you summarize why your company becomes successful and the others doesn't make the big deal?
Again, this is recorded, right? If you turn off recording, I will let you know my answers.
Okay. Maybe let's talk
I'm sure this will go to YouTube and many other venues, right?
Okay.
I will talk. We can do offline, maybe.
Okay. So Kai, I think your emphasis on the importance of betting on the technology trends is very important. Just so looking forward, I'd like to hear your opinions. Like, what are the important technology trends you think?
That's a good question. I mean, obviously, the trend of going to you know, we see several trends. We all see them, right? We see we're moving to use flash memory away from using spindles in certain market segments. That probably makes a lot of sense. And how do you lower the cost? You know, there are companies building uses some form of deduplication into flash memory storage system, and a flash storage system come in different ways. So I think that's a known trend, and that, you know, if you see that trend today, it's probably a little late. Probably should have seen that trend 5 years ago. And going forward, I think the new model people are experiencing using some form of cloud to minimize the cost, where, you know, a lot of small companies are no longer running their own private data centers. How do we see that trend going to bigger and bigger companies and bigger customers? And that's an interesting trend. I mean, I personally have not decided that's the case. One argument against that is network bandwidth problem hasn't really been solved. If it doesn't really solve in terms of the cost and the bandwidth improvement, doesn't solve, I think that probably will take a very long time. And, you know, you see that Amazon, Mozy offer disk shipping services and to move data in, and charging very little money. Moving data out, they charge you a lot of money. Once you have your data, you can't move it away. So things like this may get worked out, but I think in the future, I haven't seen very clearly that whether that trend will be successful yet. Not a very complete answer.
Hi, Kai. I'm Keith Smith from Network Appliance. So you had the slide about why large companies struggle with innovation, and I certainly, you know, I've worked at big companies, and a lot of that resonates. Data Domain is now essentially a big company. I mean, your revenue numbers are over $1 billion. Admittedly, you're a piece of EMC rather than a separate company, but I'm wondering whether you have any perspective based on Data Domain as a large company about how a bigger company can continue to innovate.
Yes. Keith, clearly you publicly agree with me. I hope that doesn't get into your trouble. But obviously, many of the items I show there were from the experience I witnessed after the acquisition, right? If you guys are looking at the Data Domain product line and the new release launches, are any of them really interesting since 2009? I mean, here's my general comments, right? So before that, I think every time I make a trip to Data Domain, and a lot of people talking to me about interesting technical ideas. We have a lot of discussions going on, so on and so forth. After that, our discussions are different. I mean, a lot of people still want to talk to me, but they talk about other subjects. It just somehow, so I summarized the incentive or the motivation somehow decreasing over time. And when that happens, just not enough innovation juice going on.
Sorry, if I wish MC. I have a question because you address the research on the academic side, but there is research in the industrial companies, in the big companies. The question is, how do you see the balance? Because, you know, many of here we are researchers from the industry, not from the academia. So.
Yes. Very good question. I actually had a slide about that I didn't show. So my observation is that if you look at the front runners of our industry, most of them actually don't have research labs. Like Apple killed their research lab in 97 when Steve Jobs went back, right? They had a research lab before. And you look at Amazon, Google, Facebook, where you can keep going, Cisco, EMC, arguably have no you know, the traditional research lab that focuses on publishing ideas and so on and so forth. The guys who have research labs, you know, bigger research labs like IBM and Microsoft, don't, how do I put this? I can't find, it's very difficult to find a disruptive type of product that's developed in a company mainly due to the researchers. My guess is that the researchers are not exposed to learning markets. They're focusing on the continuous research from their university PhD thesis or other things. So this lacking of exposed to market may lead to that issue. Like in the deduplication space, you guys have read a lot of papers, you see that the industry research lab only start looking at this issue in 2007. We already deployed products, sold a lot of them for several years before they even thinking this is an interesting thing to work on. Why is that? Why Kinect from Microsoft, that's a hot product, was actually acquisition of PrimeSense, an Israeli company, startup. Why not from the research labs? So I don't know the answer, but I suspect the, you know, not exposing to understanding market. I mean, people are very smart, I think, but if they don't understand what problem they should be working on, they wouldn't be able to make that contribution. Now, the other, I think, is the researchers are so far away from the product roadmap. The group that decides on product roadmap. And why do I feel that way? You know, one example is EMC, Data Domain, then later EMC, had a very small lab at Princeton, like three or four people for working for 2 years. Those three or four people actually deliver two really important features for a new product for Data Domain. One is the boosting feature. The other is the wide area network bandwidth acceleration for when they do data duplication, when they do data replication. Four people can do that. But why 1,000 people invest in 20 years, you don't have such a great example? So that's, I think, largely due to we have those four people, but we have access to the product roadmap meeting. We understand, we have a lot of knowledge about what market may need. And so invest enough time and people would be able to come out something very relevant.
But this is a good example that it can be done.
Yeah.
Research insight could, if you bring the researcher what they need to do, maybe.
Yeah, I think research is great. I think that the two things I'm mentioning about are, but most of the big companies have trouble with. Okay.
Randall Burns, Johns Hopkins. So you were at least implicitly critical of SBIR as a program. And that's an example of an instrument that's tried to extract innovation where it exists in place in universities and in now in national labs. So I know national labs had, the DOE labs had, venture capitalists come in and look at their technology portfolio to try and identify innovation that can be commercialized. Is this process that universities push to create innovation out of their existing technology and in the labs just broken? Would you care to comment on that?
Should I answer this question with this recorded video? Or okay, so I actually think I think the intention of the SBIR program is good. I think the new twist of the SBIR is getting better, which is requiring the participant, the funded efforts to actually interact with many customers and so on. So I think there's if there's a way to somehow the SBIR program team up with the professionals who actually do, help company for a living, I mean, some really good venture capital firms, somehow hook innovators, I mean, the technical guys in universities, with people who can help them learn about market. I think that would be great. My personal observation is this, right? My personal experience. I think the technical people are trained not to listen to other people. So we're trained to give talks, right? Tell people my idea is better. We train graduate students give talk in conference. Professors give lectures in classrooms. We know more than you, essentially, right? We have very good ideas. After several years of doing this, you start losing the ability to figure out, to sense what people want. Your receptors, the number of receptors start decreasing. So I think, for example, when I first went to a customer with Brian, and after the meeting, I somehow felt I heard different things from what he heard. And it took me a long time to unprogram that part of me and to learn about how to even talk to people without making them feel I'm defensive on my idea or without trying to figure out, whether there's some really good information from what they say. I think that part somehow I feel professors, probably need to improve. And I'm not sure how to do that. I mean, it's not just SBIR funding could make that happen.